The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network. Discover a new relationship and approach to life through the space between. Join spiritual teacher Brittany Mondito for A Moment of Silence, a weekend workshop May 24th to 26th at Omega Institute's beautiful campus in Rhinebeck, New York. Everything we're searching for lies behind what we're running from, Brittany says. Reconnect with your inner sense of safety, grounding, and centeredness. Learn more today at eomega.org/thrive.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Essential Conversations with Rabbi Rami. This week's episode is part one of a two-part interview that we conducted at the 2017 Festival of Faiths in Louisville, Kentucky. I was able to have this incredible conversation with Joan Brown Campbell and Karen Armstrong. You'll learn more about them in the context of the interview. The interview was conducted on location, so pardon the ambient noise, but it was a wonderful conversation, and I know you're going to enjoy it. I'm at the 22nd Annual Festival of Faiths Gathering in Louisville, Kentucky, a nationally acclaimed celebration of music, poetry, film, art, and dialogue, with internationally renowned spiritual leaders, thinkers, and practitioners. The Festival of Faith promotes interfaith understanding, cooperation, and action, and it's organized by the Center for Interfaith Relations here in Louisville. I'm here under the auspices of Spirituality Health Magazine to do some interviews in the field with some of the presenters, and we have the incredible opportunity to talk to two amazing women, both of whom I can't call you friends because we don't know each other that well, but certainly you're my teachers and people that we have I've taught with before. And it's just an honor to be with you, Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell and Karen Armstrong. So Reverend Campbell is a devoted activist for peace and social justice who served 13 years as director of the Department of Religion at the historic Chautauqua Institution, was the first ordained woman appointed as General Secretary of the National Council of Churches of Christ in the United States, in the USA, Director of the US Office of the World Council of Churches, and she co-founded what is today the National Religious Partnership on the Environment. Karen Armstrong is an historian of religion whose books have been translated into 45 languages. I can only dream of that. In 2007, she was appointed by Kofi Annan to the high-level group of the UN Alliance of Civilizations with the task of diagnosing the causes of extremism. 2008, she was awarded the TED Prize and began working with TED on the Charter for Compassion, which was launched in the fall of 2009 and has become a global movement. Karen, Joan, thank you so much for sharing a few minutes with us on Essential Conversations. So since you're really headlining the festival, and the festival's theme is compassion, let's just start by helping people understand what your core message is. So we'll start with Karen. Karen.
Yeah. When I got the TED Prize that you mentioned, I was given a wish for a better world. And I had been disturbed by the fact that even though all the world religions emphasize the golden rule and compassion and have seen this as central to spirituality and ethics, when religious leaders came together, they rarely mentioned it. They were always talking about homosexuality or some point of doctrine or condemning this or that. And so I wanted to bring compassion to the core of life. We got a lot of religious leaders together, TED arranged it, and together we wrote a charter. Those represented six of the major world religions, so it was a sign that on this we were all in agreement, and that even though the various religious traditions are often assumed to be at loggerheads, on this we could work together for a better world. The challenge has been since then to implement it practically. And we're here in Louisville because it's going to become the center of our Compassionate Cities campaign, which is going now to be the flagship now of our movement, the whole compassion movement.
So, John, you want to jump in?
Yes, it's Working on compassion is not an easy task. In some ways, it's a misunderstood word at its depth. People think of compassion often as kindness, and it is that. Or they think of it as something nice, to be nice to people. And Karen has really been my teacher as we have taken a look at just at the word alone and helped to remind people that at its depth, compassion is life-changing. And what Karen has often pointed out, it is also dangerous. Dangerous in the sense of risks worth taking. And I think part of what we've tried to do as we've focused on compassionate cities, we have really been, we have now over 100 cities around the world that declare themselves compassionate cities. And we even, now there's some work being done to put down the criteria. So you cannot just simply say, the mayor of the city can't just say, this is a compassionate city. It's now to be listed as a compassionate city. One must be serious about this in a variety of ways. And I think one of the challenges is the word compassion is not clearly defined, or perhaps it is irreverently defined and made too easy. And Karen especially has always talked to us about the danger of compassion.
So let me ask you both a question. Because you both talk about the golden rule and its centrality to religion. So I wrote a book, I don't know which book it was, but not too long ago, called Games People Play, The Golden Rule and Why Nobody Follows It. It's not exactly the title, but that's the idea. And I went through the world's religions and said, okay, this is what they say in Hinduism, and here's how Hinduism doesn't do it. And here's what they say in Judaism, and here's how Judaism doesn't follow it. Why do you think that they, especially around women, I mean, because you know, these religions are Iron Age, Bronze Age, and the mentality is often still in that framework. And here we're saying, don't do unto others what you would not want done unto you. And yet the way we treat women in most of these religions is horrendous. How can they promote a rule that they really violate almost unconsciously?
Well, they don't really promote it. That was my point. They would often talk about anything but the golden rule. My Catholic tradition, for example, we hardly mentioned it. It was very much more accepting certain doctrines and, you know, theories of mortal sin and all this. And it was my studies that made me see the importance of this, because whatever topic I was writing about, whether it was a history of God or a history of Jerusalem or a history of fundamentalism, the material kept pushing me to this, to compassion, as either the lack of it or the struggle for it. And why do people not? Because people don't want to do it. People don't want to be compassionate, really. They like to say, think of themselves as compassionate, but they often prefer to be superior or see themselves in a different category, because and it's been slight, there's slight differences in every tradition, but the Confucian tradition, Confucius was the first person to enunciate the golden rule and have it written down. And his followers asked him, what can we practice all day and every day? And what is the central thread that runs through your teaching? And he said, shu, which means likening to the self. Look into your own heart, discover what gives you pain, and then refuse under any circumstance whatsoever to inflict that pain on anyone else. He said, do not impose on others what you yourself do not desire. And so all day and every day, you're being asked to transcend the ego. And for this, Confucius, it was political. And this is a point too. His whole point was, he spent his life going round to the various courts of China, telling rulers that they must not impose on others what they would not like done for themselves. That was, otherwise, he said, we will destroy one another. And so that is never more true than it is today. because unless now we implement the golden rule globally, so that we treat all peoples, or ensure that all peoples, whoever they are, whether we like them or not, are treated as we would wish to be treated, the world is going to be unviable. And resentment has accelerated. And what the terrorism that we're seeing now is simply the fact that the state has lost the monopoly of violence. Up until fairly recently, the state, in order to be a state, had to control all the violence, have all the weapons at their disposal. In the past, all the people suppressed by the state, that would have been 90% of the population before the modern period, would love to have committed terrorist acts against their rulers, but they had no violence. They had no means to do so. Now, with the easy availability of weapons, and right here in the United States, it's tremendously easy to lay your hands on weapons, and the ease of travel, more money, and easy and advanced communications means that the state no longer has the monopoly of violence, and people who feel oppressed or have a grievance are able to challenge us in this way. But if they had been treated in a more decent manner, this might not be happening.
So I want to come back to that for a second, but it sounded to me like, Joan, you wanted to jump in?
Well, I think one of the problems we have with the word compassion is that people see it as being nice. There's very little study or even acceptance. If you press people a little on why do you believe the golden rule, they actually do better if you say, what do you mean by the golden rule, than simply by the word compassion. Compassion is often, people receive that word as saying, well, I'm nice to my neighbor, I'm good to my children. I mean, the sacrificial nature of it is really, I think it's deeply misunderstood at that level. But this is not something about being nice or making things better for people that may already have better, but the fact that it requires a certain amount of sacrifice and a high degree of risk. And I think we very rarely think of compassion as risky. And yet I think at its depth, that is what it is. I've always been a little bit interested in why, if you say compassion, you get one response. If you say the golden rule, you get a different response from people.
So what's the difference?
To some degree, the golden rule is thought of as a rule. Therefore, it's thought of as a command or something that you ought to do. People seem to interpret it with a little more depth than the word. Even if you look it up, if you look up the word compassion. And I've done a fair amount of work in Cuba in the last, 20 years of my life. And I wanted to work with them on compassion. And compassion does not translate, from their standpoint, into Spanish in a way that it does. Almost everyone I talked to said, well, it translates to mean being sorry for or feeling sad about something.
Discover a new relationship and approach to life through the space between. Join spiritual teacher Brittany Mondito for A Moment of Silence, a weekend workshop May 24th to 26th at Omega Institute's beautiful campus in Rhinebeck, New York. Everything we're searching for lies behind what we're running from, Brittany says. Reconnect with your inner sense of safety, grounding, and centeredness. Learn more today at eomega.org/thrive.
It doesn't drive someone to say, what I've learned from Karen Armstrong is that what you have to see in it is it's a command to change something, to take away what it is that creates the problem and interject something of reverence and of curing what it is that creates the problem. But I think one of the difficulties in talking about compassion is the misunderstanding of the meaning of the word.
Do you think, both of you, or maybe what role does religion play in this? You know, seems to me that religion is more part of the problem than is part of the solution. That I know you're saying that if people have been treated better by whatever powers that, you know, they live under, maybe we wouldn't have the terrorist issues that we have today. But I see it somewhat differently. I don't think we can take the religion out of terrorism, whether it's in Islam or Christianity or Judaism or Hinduism or Buddhism in Myanmar, that if it wasn't for a specific theology that someone drew from a tradition, I'm not saying it's the core theology, but if they couldn't hook it to God in some way and then hook God to the state, that or to politics, that without that, I think it's more difficult. Without subsuming the individual to something greater, either, you know, communism or the state or God or something, it's much more difficult to get people to be terrorists.
I'm not sure that that's true.
Okay, that's what I'm asking.
No, I mean, if there have been... this is the latest fashion, is Islamic terrorism. But if you look back at the 60s, 50s, 60s, the Bader-Meinhof organization, right, this was highly secular and leftist. And then there were before that you had, it was the Russians who invented suicide bombing, for example. Russian revolutionaries, not activated by religion. This is just the latest.
Yeah, so I should have been more careful. So not religion specifically, but some ideology beyond the individual that they can surrender themselves to, and that motivates them to...
I don't know. You see, I think we've got to reckon with the violence in the human psyche.
Okay.
We're a violent species. We came to, for the largest part of our evolutionary history, we were professional killers as hunter-gatherers, and using our big brains to fight and kill animals much bigger and more powerful than ourselves. And before the invention of agriculture, we depended upon killing. And that is especially inbred in the male sex. And if you look at these absurd games that men play, football and rugger, where they hurl themselves at each other, and young men throughout history have been drawn to the battlefield. Now, I was talking to a military philosopher in Britain, and he said the greatest incentive that draws men to the battlefield has been boredom, a sense of the utter triviality of life, a sense of meaninglessness. And forensic psychiatrists, who are not liberal softies like me, but one of them was one of the chief of these was a former CIA officer, and he interviewed all the people involved in the 9/11 plot who were incarcerated in Guantanamo Bay. And his findings showed that religion had very little to do with it. Only 20% of these people had a regular Muslim upbringing. Others were either new converts who knew very little about the tradition. Like, that's what the recent bombing in, the recent terrorist attack in London. It was a convert with a criminal record, hardly a devout Muslim. Else they were self-taught. Two young wannabe jihadists left Birmingham in the UK to go to Syria, and they'd ordered a book from Amazon called Islam for Dummies, which shows the depth of their understanding of the faith. Or else they were not observant until they joined the movement. And he said that the biggest cause of it was a sense of pointlessness in life.
That, I mean, that's fascinating. I'm just going to ask, push it one more time and see if there's something else we can say about it. When I look at Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, just focused on those, not at their best, but at their most political, their most tribal, I mean, their gods are rooted in violence.
I'm writing a book about scripture at the moment in all religious traditions. And all these scriptures deal with violence. They have to deal with violence because It's part of life.
We're violent. Yeah.
We're violent. It's what they are. And very often, you know, the tribal ones, I was just writing about the early Jewish scriptures. Yes, Yahweh's a warrior god.
Yeah.
Because they are fighting for their lives in the pre-state days. But you have it in India too. Indra, very violent deity, because that's what these Aryans live by violence, by stealing other people's cows and killing. Then they move, but violence is part and parcel of our lives. And any kind of scripture or spirituality that ignores that is out in cloud cuckoo land.
Well, then it's like fairy tales, or like Grimm's
yes.
fairy tales bring out the violence. So, Joan, you were talking about how difficult it is to cultivate this compassion. It sounds like it's almost fighting human evolution. Do you see it as a step in human evolution? I mean, we're still violent, so there must be something evolutionarily valid about our violence. And then compassion is pushing against that. Is it the next level of human evolution, or are you just fighting thousands of years of intrinsic human
I think it's not. Most people that you would talk to, just people that would attend a mosque or people that would attend a church or synagogue, I don't think that they think in these terms.
Oh, sure.
I mean, or that deeply, or that, you know, either scientifically or as students. It's more we're trying to look at how do you address something that seems to be within us. And to some degree, there's a high degree of protection within us. And how does that protection play out in the word of compassion? I mean, oftentimes, I think people do not act professional, do not act with passion or compassion, partly because it looks risky. And I think we're in an era right now where there's a low risk. I get very distressed at times. I lived through the Civil Rights Movement and worked for Dr. King. And it seemed, at least to me, not maybe because I was younger, but I think not, people, particularly the clergy, I'm a Protestant, they were far more willing to take a risk. Now I see clergy being very careful. They have a job to worry about. They're worried about how people might feel about something. When in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement, people had a feeling, not all people, but there was a very large number of people that were saying, this is wrong. This is part of our history. We have to do something about this. We didn't say compassion would be give you a direction, but it was the way the response came. And now what I see is a lot of caution about doing anything that is risky. Might risk your money, might risk your life. I mean, and it's getting worse, not better. This whole idea that if you step outside of your house, you might get into trouble. I mean, it's disturbing to me. Now, I don't know that this is true in any country.
Oh, yes,
it's certainly true here. Yeah.
I think so. There is definite kind of caution and constant self-protection, insurance, and constant preoccupation with one's health, and jogging, and it's a search for immortality, in a way.
Well, there's an interesting theory now that as science maybe is on the threshold of letting us live longer and longer.
That's a terrible thought.
And, well, one of the things they're saying will happen is if they can get it to the point where you only die from an accidental thing, no one will leave the house.
Yes.
Because it's too risky.
Or I love children. My children said, well, if we lived forever, we'd never get any money that we inherit from our parents.
You've been listening to the first part of a two-part conversation that I had at the 2017 Festival of Faith in Louisville, Kentucky, with Joan Brown Campbell and Karen Armstrong. We're going to broadcast the second half of the conversation next week. I hope you'll tune in. Thanks for listening.
What is it you really want in life? No matter what you've been through, you can still achieve it. I'm Sandra Ann Taylor, and in my Energy Activation podcast, we'll explore the science of manifestation, and I'll give you specific techniques to shift your energy in order to make your dreams a reality. I also do live energy readings, and you can be a part of the show by emailing your questions to me at sandrataylor.net. Join me on the mindbodyspirit.fm podcast network or wherever you get your podcasts.